Very much appreciate your presence tonight. We're so thankful to have all of this audience, especially those visiting with us. We're glad you're here. And I'm grateful for the prayers that we prayed together, and especially those words on my behalf. I need them, and I'm thankful for that. I appreciate the songs that we've sung tonight. And let me say that I don't know what Scott is fussing about, because I asked him, he asked about songs tonight, and I said, well, just sing some songs on the dangers of atheism. And I thought, well, now, that ought to be simple enough. And he's talking about having a hard time. My PowerPoint keeps disappearing. I don't know if that's personal or what, but it's gone again. So, this one? Okay. Now we're finding something now. We probably got several of them there now. All right, there we go. Thank you. We give direction, we take direction. We don't mind that at all. I do want to talk to you tonight, as I mentioned, about a subject that might seem rather odd in some ways for this audience. We talk about faith in God and the folly of atheism. People who come out to a gospel meeting on a Monday night, people who are members of the church, is this really what you need to talk about? Is this really the subject that needs to be preached? I don't know. I never do know. I'll tell you something happened to me within the last couple of years. We had a guy, young man in his 20s, not married, living at home, who moved out of his folks' house. Folks are members of the church, good people, faithful. And he announced he was an atheist. And that was pretty stunning to me. I had a chance to talk with him. And I told him I didn't really think he was an atheist. I thought he was just lazy. I thought he was just, you know, just too hard to try to be decent and work for a living and serve the Lord, and he was looking for a way out. But he had convinced himself he was an atheist. He had fallen in with a crowd that thought that was smart. And, you know, that's I can say this, my perception is that atheism is more popular now than any time in my lifetime. It used to be a rarity. Now I think you find people who boast about it, because there's sort of a veneer of intellectualism involved in that. You know, they think, well, we've moved on, we're smarter. I asked this young man, I said, well, I tell you what, don't leave me hanging. I mean, if you know something I don't know, you tell me. Won't you convert me? Didn't get much traction on that, because I don't think it really comes from reason. I don't question the intelligence of people who make such claims. They may be extremely intelligent people, but I don't believe that they reach a point where they doubt the existence of God based on reason. And that's strange, because I think people look at folks like you and they think you're the one with the reason problem. So you got faith. And to this world, what faith means, faith is that which allows you to believe in what's not reasonable. That's the way they define faith. And what I would say is, faith is not opposed to reason. My faith is opposed to sight. It's opposed to fruition. Paul said, why does a man hope for what he sees, what he has? But it's not opposed to reason. In fact, I'm convinced that faith, real faith, is always based on reason. And when you read the scriptures, you find that. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, but sanctify the Lord God in your heart, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. So I think there are very good reasons why we believe in God. And what I want to share with you tonight, let me say a couple of things about it. First of all, not one thing I'll say tonight is original with me. I claim no originality in what I'm going to say. The arguments that I'm making have been made by brighter fellows than I am and made better than I can make them. But they are things that to me are solid, that appeal to me, that I think will stand the test of examination. So that's my only claim tonight. I share with you what I believe to be true. And I would say that there's a lot more to be said about this subject. What I'm going to say tonight isn't even all I know, much less all there is to be said. But I want to share with you at least a part of a series of lessons on this subject of evidences. I want to look at one argument in particular. There are several arguments, important arguments, that I think prove the existence of God. I think the existence of the universe has always seemed to me to be a pretty solid argument. We're not going to take much time on that tonight. But, Psalm 19, people say, well, the Bible doesn't spend a lot of time proving the existence of God. That may be true. But it certainly makes the point that it is the reasonable thing to believe. When the psalmist wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth his handiwork. Day unto day uttereth speech. Night unto night showeth knowledge." The sky teaches all the time. The heavens declare the glory of God all the time. And I tell you, it doesn't make any difference if you're from Baghdad or Bugtussle or wherever you're from, whatever language you speak. There's no language nor speech where their voice is not heard. Their line goes through all the earth. Their words to the end of the world. That's exactly right. And that's all the time. And so the very fact that things exist makes it plain that they had to come from somewhere. Because things don't come from nowhere. That's not science. The idea that there was nothing, there was an absolute vacuum, and then something does not make sense. Or that material things might somehow be eternal. It doesn't make sense. And so really the difference between the atheist and the Christian might be, or the believer might be, summed up in this regard. That Christians believe that creation demands a creator. And the atheist says you have creation without a creator. Which of those seems more reasonable, I would say, to anybody? Another thing that we certainly would want to dwell on if we had more time would be the design of the universe. The beautiful design of the universe. The Hebrew writer said that every house is builded by some man, but he that buildeth all things is God. And when you look at the universe itself, you see the design that is integral within it. We're talking about, we'll just mention Florida College this afternoon, or as we're eating together. You know, I've only been on the campus there one time in my life. I went one time to the lectures in Florida as a visitor, and I went with a group of fellows, and they said, "Hey, they're launching the space shuttle. Why don't we just go down early and we'll swing over there by Canaveral and we'll watch that thing from a distance go up, and then the lectures start Monday night." So we got no sleep and we went from West Virginia to Florida so I could watch a little tiny, but you know, we didn't even get to see it because it was cold that morning. They canceled the launch. So anyway, I got to see Central Florida, go back over to Tampa. And the lectures started Monday night, Monday morning, or Tuesday morning. They have the lectures all day. We're in the Tuesday morning, and then between lectures, announced that the Challenger had blown up. They had launched it that Tuesday, but the tragedy happened, terrible thing. You know, you see that. Maybe you've had an opportunity to see some of those rockets, the space shuttle, the Saturn rocket that they have a model of up in Huntsville. It's a remarkable thing. Nobody in their right mind would look at something like that and say, "You know, I think that probably just came together just accidentally." I really think maybe, I mean, it doesn't look likely, but if you give it trillions a year, I don't care how much time you can imagine. There's not a chance that something like that just happened. You see design, you see a designer. Now that's common sense. And so the universe that craft is set to explode is just dismissed as being an accident that came about without any thought, without any personal power. I think the existence of life is another lesson that we've thought about through the years. I want to tell you, If you think that a rock can't explain itself, creating itself, or being eternal, you tell me how in the world life without a first cause. One thing we know, life does not come from non-living things. Life comes from life. And the very fact that we have life demands a creator. You know, numbers, I get lost in numbers. And I don't make any secret about that. But some numbers will lose anybody. And there was a fellow I was reading, there's a guy, he's a professor up at Lehigh in Pennsylvania. And he believes in intelligent design. He believes that the universe had a beginning. And so he was talking about that, writing about that subject, and he said, let me try to explain to you the probability of one protein molecule coming about by chance. And this is the way he explained it. He said, imagine the Sahara Desert, which is another way, imagine North Africa. It's 3 billion square miles. And imagine if you took one grain of sand and you marked that grain of sand, and then you dropped it somewhere in the desert. And then you took a fella and you said, go find the one grain of sand that's marked in this 3.5 million square miles. And by the way, you blindfold it. What are the chances he would come back with a grain of sand? Suppose he did send him back. He's got to do it twice. He does it again. Send him back a third time. He said, that's the chance. Mathematically, that one protein molecule could be brought into existence by chance. And he said, by the way, it takes 200 of those protein molecules before anything can be considered something approaching life. That's the chance. Doesn't sound like very good odds to me. I'm not a gambling guy, but I wouldn't bet the farm on that one. I got a chance years ago, opportunity, to go to Birmingham over here and to hear a debate between John Lennox and Christopher Hitchens. Mr. Lennox was a professor from Oxford, I don't know which college. Anyway, he was defending intelligent design, and Hitchens is the guy that's died recently, but he was the atheist, you know. So anyway, they had this debate. One thing that really was depressing to me, I thought Mr. Lennox did a good job. But after the debate was over, both men were sitting at these tables, and people just lined up to meet them. There was a crowd of people lined up to shake Christopher Hitchens' hand and get his autograph. And I thought, you know, if Hitchens was right, the news that he's bringing would be the worst news you could imagine. Who in the world would say, oh, I am so, thank you so much for taking away all my hope and for making me feel totally useless. Thank you so much. Just excited about it. Just so foolish. Anyway, during the debate, Mr. Lennox was asked in the question period by some of the audience, he said, you know, here you are, you teach at Oxford and you believe in creation. Many folks like you at Oxford? He said, well, there certainly are some. He said, especially in the math department. He said, that's what I teach. I teach math. We know the numbers. And that's exactly what he was talking about. I mean, the chances of this all happening randomly? Impossible. The existence of life is a good argument. That's not my subject either. I need to get to my subject. I want to talk about a fourth subject. Fourth reason why we can have confidence that God exists. And I'm trying primarily here, as you notice, not to just say, because the Bible says so. Because that does not always appeal to other people. They have not yet maybe learned how important the Bible is and what it really is. But just as the psalmist says, the heaven is the glory of God. Reason demands God. A fourth reason involves the existence of morality. I think the moral argument for God is a very powerful argument, and always has been. What we mean by morality is the things that exist, a way of conduct, choices to be made, that are beyond just personal preference. Sometimes contrary to personal preference. They're right. The existence of right and wrong, not just I like, I don't like, demands the existence of one higher than we are. Two people or two groups of people might have their preferences, but there is a right. Where does that come from? It comes from one above us. It has to. The existence of morality proves that. We recognize the moral law. These words are familiar, aren't they? Mr. Jefferson wrote a long time ago, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Self-evident. That all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's not our preference. We say that these are rights. They come from above. And men have no right to deny them because this is right. And what's contrary to that is not just what we don't like, it's wrong. He recognized that. The world should recognize that fact. You know, little kids know that. I ran across a book several years ago, maybe you've seen this. A guy wrote a book and he called it All I Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. And he talks about how that the fundamentals that children know are things that adults need not forget. Children know, share, play fair, don't hit people, clean up your own mess. Sometimes it's not pleasant to clean up your own mess, isn't it? So why should you do it? Well, because it's right. Why don't you hit people? I want to hit him. Well, it's not right. A little child knows that. It takes a philosopher to decide that no, we don't have morality. My proposition might be laid out this way. Every law has a lawgiver. And there is a moral law. Therefore, there has to be a moral lawgiver. As I said, some philosophers try to defeat that by denying morality. Moral relativism. Relativist. They teach such ideas as this. All morals are relative. There's no absolute standard of justice or rightness. It's all a matter of opinion. You like chocolate, I like vanilla. Another fellow defined it this way. He said, moral relativism is the view that ethical standards, morality, positions of right or wrong are culturally based, therefore subject to a person's individual choice. We can all decide what is right for ourselves. You know, all we're about is just what we like. Life is like a monopoly game. You just grab all the money and land you can, then at the end of the game, you just put it back in the box. And that sounds good to some people, like the young man I talked about earlier, who want to put the idea of accountability far from their minds. It's very comforting on some strange level to them to think that we're just here by ourselves and we're making up the rules as we go. That's great until, you see, we run into somebody else who wants to do us harm. Oh, it's perfectly good in theory to say, well, morals are relative. But you know what I've noticed is that when somebody steals from me, now that's wrong. And somebody cheats me, that's wrong. And somebody wants to knock me on the head and leave me in an alley somewhere. Now, that's just wrong. There's a great story. I read one of these things about a student. It was in some one of the colleges in Indiana. Anyway, a professor of ethics, he gave the students an assignment. He said, now, I want you to write on ethics. I'm not going to tell you what to write. It has to be this long. Turn it at this time. You make your own proposition. You defend it. And he had a young man who was an atheist in the class. And he wrote a paper on all morals are relative. There's no such thing as a moral standard. And he rather eloquently went through a lot of reasons why. That there's no such thing as what's fair what's right, what's just. It really is just opinion. It comes back to preference. Variable. He turns the paper in on time. It's the right length. The professor reads it. And he gives the guy an F. And he puts down below the F, "I don't like blue folders." Well, you can imagine what happens. The kid gets the paper, goes berserk, goes to the professor's office, and he says, "Now you tell me how this, what's right about this? How could you do this to me?" The professor says, let me see your paper. I don't remember all of it. I read a lot of papers." So he reads the paper. He says, "Oh yeah." He said, "You're the guy that said there's no right, there's no fairness, that it's all opinion. That's what I believe. Well, I don't like blue folders." And it took a minute, but finally the light came on. The inherent contradiction involved in that. And it's true of a lot more than just college kids. It's not fair. People on the one hand talk about there's no God and morality is relative, and the other hand they turn around and say it's not fair. The hypocrisy involved in all of that can't be missed. Let me tell you something. We might owe... In one way, people might talk as if morality is all relative. But on the other hand, we know there's some things that are wrong. When a group of conspirators get together and decide we're going to hijack planes and run them into buildings and kill people by the hundreds, by the thousands, that's wrong. And everybody knows it's wrong. I had a chance to hear a few years ago. My family and I went up to Washington, D.C. And one of the things we did was we went to the Holocaust Museum downtown there. Whatever you think about the politics of all these guys involved in this particular thing, it's a very interesting place to visit and very moving. And they show a lot of images. I wondered how they were going to do that. How can you just have anybody walk through the door and show some of the things that they wanted to show you? Graphic images of people who were emaciated. Or corpses stacked up, you know, half as high as that window there. They had an interesting way of doing that. They would have out of the floor little cylinders that were too tall for little ones to see over. But the adults could peer in and look at a screen and they would show you things. Things that really you didn't want to show children. Things that, you know, were not pleasant for me to see. One of the exhibits that everybody could see, though, was, I thought, simple and yet moving. It was a collection of shoes, that's what that is, that had been taken from people who'd been snatched up all over Europe. I trust that the young folks here are aware of the Holocaust and what we're talking about here. In maybe the late 30s and the early 40s, when the Nazis grabbed up Jews all over Europe and then eventually decided what they would do with them is, having put some in work camps, they would also build death camps, and they would kill them industrially, gassing them to death in many cases. These people had been taken off the streets and out of their lives, put on trains, taken to Dachau and Auschwitz and other places, Buchenwald, and they were worked to death or murdered. And all these shoes represent people, grandfathers and grandmothers and grandchildren and people of all ages who were murdered. How can people do that? How could people feel good about rounding up people and murdering them just out of a hatred of their background or of their genealogy? See what they did to those folks, at least the ones that survived, who were involved in that. They took them down to Nuremberg in Germany, and they held a trial, and they tried them and charged them with crimes against humanity. What does that mean? It means that what they did was even outside the boundary of what we call war. This is just pure murder on an industrial scale. Millions. This is wrong. This violates moral law. They may not have been too discerning in all the things that did violate moral law, but even they recognized, the world recognized, that this is too far. My point is that if there is no God, then what the Nazis did was just a matter of opinion. You think it's wrong? They thought it was right. Who's to say? We know better than that. Every law has a lawgiver. There is a moral law. There are some things that are wrong, and therefore, there is a moral lawgiver. Which brings us to this point. People say, well, you know, speaking of that, how come your moral lawgiver let so many bad things happen? I'm glad you brought the Holocaust up. How can there be a God? And these kind of things take place. Well, there are a lot of good answers, maybe, that we could give to that question. But let me just make this point. Whenever I hear an atheist, and I hear this a lot, and you do too if you listen to me, they always talk about how can there be a God in such a corrupt, wicked world in which we live? How can God be good and allow these bad things to happen? The very question acknowledges goodness. It acknowledges the idea that things ought to be a certain way. Where did you learn that? How do you explain that? To say that things ought to be a certain way acknowledges that there is a right. To say that a line is crooked is to know what a straight line is. The famous writer C.S. Lewis started out as a typical intellectual British atheist, and he came to be a believer, at least that far. And he wrote about how he used to be. And he said, you know, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and so unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What I was comparing this universe, what was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Every time you hear an atheist talk about goodness or about evil, he's acknowledging by that very argument the God that he denies. He wouldn't know goodness or evil if there were not one higher than himself who was standing for that which is good and condemning that which is evil. Another illustration has been used sometimes. You take these two images here. We ate at the White House tonight, by the way. But which one of these two images would you say is more correct? Well, I didn't draw either one of them, but if I were picking one, I would pick the one over here to your left. That looks a lot more like the White House. How do you know that? Well, we've seen the White House. That's how we know that. And when it comes to good and evil, how do you know what's evil? How do you know that something is amiss? Because you know in your bones what's right. That concept of right demands a lawgiver, a moral lawgiver, and that is God. The concepts of evil and good, wrong and right, presuppose a moral, objective, moral standard. Again, beyond desire, beyond individual preference, sometimes contrary to it. I think that's a valid point. Here you are, and you're walking down the street, and you see somebody over here that is getting beat up, abused, calling for help. What should you do? Well, I tell you what I might like to do. I might like to run the other way. That's what I would like to do. But you go to try to help because that's the right thing to do. That's the point. What's right isn't just what's natural, and sometimes it's contrary to nature. How can human beings ever be responsible for creating right when we don't even like right? But we are called and compelled to do right. There's somebody else in this picture, superhuman, who sets the standard. Not arbitrarily, by the way, but according to his own nature, and that someone is God. I like this quote. One fellow wrote, morality is not arbitrary. It's not do this and don't do that because I'm God and I said so. God does not make rules up on a whim. The standard of rightness is the very nature of God himself. Infinite justice, infinite love. First John chapter 4 and verse 8. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. Love is not an arbitrary choice. Love is right because God made all things and He is love. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16, Peter commends us to the path of holiness. He says, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy. God is holiness. God is love. It can be no other way. Right is determined by the nature of God. And as we are more like God, then we are what He would have us to be. Could it be any other way? Who decides what's good and what's evil? I like this quote as well. One fellow put it this way. He said, you know, relativism poses as humble by saying, we're not smart enough to know what the truth is or that there is any universal truth. A fellow named Alan Dershowitz, a Harvard law professor, he likes the television cameras. You'll see him a lot of times in such various circumstances. And he will chide people. He will say, well, I know what's wrong. I spent my life fighting what's wrong, but I don't know what's right. And I'll tell you, you don't know what's right either. And the minute you say you know what's right, then you stop growing. And he'll go on and on railing about that. How in the world would a fellow know what was wrong if he didn't know what was right? And he must think he's right about the idea that none of you know what's right. It's sort of a self-defeating nature of that kind of language. Sounds good, though, doesn't it? He's so humble, he wouldn't claim to know what was right. This guy really made the point here. Not talking about him specifically, but about that idea in general. He said, you look carefully at what's happening. It sounds humble, but it's anything but, he said. It's like a servant saying, I'm just not smart enough to know the person who's my master. Or even if I had a master. The result is that I don't really have a master. That I can be my own master. That in reality is what happens to relativists. They claim to be too lowly to know the truth. They exalt themselves then as the supreme arbiter of what they can think and what they can do. It's not humility. It's the essence of pride. I'm God. Everybody's their own God. There's nothing humble about that. I tell you, when you think about the myths that are perpetrated about morality, we will not be able to cover all of them, but let me suggest just a couple before we close tonight. I hear people say things like this. They say, well, you talk about a moral standard, but you look around, morals change. Morals have changed. I think when people say things like that, they have confused what people do for what they ought to do. You know, conduct certainly changes. And you might find a society that is more and more lax, but the standard is absolute and not variable. One fellow put it this way. He said, it's the difference between sociology and morality, the difference between what's descriptive and what's prescriptive. Sociology describes what people do and how they act, he said, but morality talks about what people ought to do and how they ought to act. And people might indeed, they might change their behavior and they might more and more live in a certain way. That by a long shot does not mean that morality has changed. You'll hear things like this. People will say, you know, you guys talk about how premarital sex is wrong. You should get with the times. More and more people, more and more couples living together, living without marriage. Well, that may be true, but it's presumptive to say that somehow that makes it right, in the same way that you could say, you know, more and more people murder each other. What does that prove? Does that prove that murder somehow is no longer wrong? Let me ask you to turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. You know, there's nothing, not one thing new under the sun. There's not one sin that men wallow in now that is new to the world. We might create a new drug to get drunk on, but drunkenness is not new. There's nothing new under the sun.
And when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, Christians who lived in a corrupt society, he asked them, "Do you not know that the unrighteous shall not inherit the kingdom of God? Be not deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor abusers of themselves with mankind," two terms that relate to homosexuality, "nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor extortioners shall inherit the kingdom of God." By the way, they had known, they had lived in some of those sins, but now they had been washed and sanctified and justified. Don't be deceived. I don't care how many people do. I don't care who does it. Wrong is wrong. That goes back a long way, doesn't it? You think back to Genesis chapter 6. And I always think about this passage when I think about this argument, you know, that seems to imply, because so many people today do something, that makes it good. The Lord looked at the world of Noah's day. Verse 5, the text tells us, "God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth. It grieved him in his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and the fowl of the air. It repenteth me that I have made them." I think about that. Sociology would say everybody's doing it. Morality would say it's wrong. And if everybody in the world but eight people are guilty, it's still wrong. So, morals have changed. Morality doesn't change. The new morality is still the same old immorality, no matter how popular it might be. Somebody says, I didn't work out, did it? Somebody says, well, you know, morals vary widely all over the world over time. You're not recognizing the fact that different societies have different moral standards. Well, that's a big subject, but let me just offer this thought. Not really. Not as much as as people claim. Somebody put together this list. I don't take credit for it. But I have seen this little thing over here. If you go over to overseas in Europe, Paris, they have one of these stelas of the Hammurabi's Code, they call it. A Sumerian king who lived many years ago, 1750 B.C.? It's the code of this particular king, his laws for his people. And people who can read such things have translated it. Here's one of the laws that Hammurabi gave his people. If one cuts down a tree on someone else's land, he will pay for it. And I thought, you know, I think we got that same law, Bibb. Yeah, I believe. That's just people, isn't it? You know, wrong is wrong. It really had, all those years have passed, different part of the world. You go to ancient Egypt, you'll find these precepts through history. Terrify not men, or God will terrify you. I'd say amen to that. Juvenal, he was the Roman writer, you remember, of the first century A.D. What good man regards any misfortune as no concern of his? That kind of thoughtlessness would be morality then and now. This is from some of the old sagas from Iceland. I saw in hell beguilers of others' wives. What society has ever said adultery was right? You might have a lot of adultery in a particular place, but it doesn't mean anybody ever thought that was really a virtue. Him who fails to honor them, that is father and mother, every work of piety is in vain. Honor your father and mother. Is there any society that does not recognize that's the way things ought to be? The point is that morality really hasn't changed so much. Again, one more time, Mr. Lewis writes, think of a country. Think of any country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. Where is that anywhere in the world at any time been considered a virtue? You might as well try to imagine a country where 2 and 2 make 5. I think that's right. Oh, morality changes. Not really. Not really. Morals are mere instincts. They're the product of evolution. This is another idea. You know, that just doesn't make good nonsense, does it? In the first place, morals, you know, materials don't have morals. How would a moral evolve? And would we say about a murderer, he just got bad molecules? Is that his problem? He hasn't evolved enough? We know better than that. And by the way, how does that fit the idea of survival of the fittest? You know, if we're suggesting that men evolved, and the idea of evolution, as I've heard it taught, is survival of the fittest. That is, those who are the leanest, the fittest, the toughest, they're the ones that go forward. How does that teach a man to go into a burning building to save a helpless child? That looks like the opposite of what these guys are suggesting in survival of the fittest. By the way, my time's running out, but let me share a quick story with you if I can. I read this recently, and it just sort of struck me. There's a book written, this is not written by a Christian by any means, it's written by a guy named Robert Lacey, and he tells a story about Charles Darwin. Darwin, you remember, was the man who was famous for writing The Origin of Species, and he is the man most associated with the doctrine of the survival of the fittest. Turns out, Mr. Lacey says, that Darwin came up with that theory many years before he published it, but that he was concerned about the impact, about all of the criticism he would get for it. He knew the how that would stir people's hearts, so he held back, and he didn't publish. And then one day, horror of horrors to him, another guy named Alfred Russel Wallace, not familiar with him, Wallace sent a paper to Darwin that basically said the same thing. He had come up with this theory independently. And it put Darwin in an awful position, because now he wants to be famous, and he's just waiting for the right time to give this point of view, and somebody else has come up with it now and written to him and said, oh, would you please help me get this published? What does he do? Well, Mr. Lacey says he could have done several things, including destroy the letter and pretend it never arrived. He could have just delayed and done nothing. You know what he did? He passed it on to the right people, and he said with a note, I hope you will approve Wallace's sketch. Let me know and I'll tell him what you say. And they went on to publish the paper together. And then later Darwin wrote The Origin of Species and, of course, became famous. But I just thought, does anybody else see the irony in that? Here are these two guys trying to convince the world, doggy dog. And they say, well, no, after you. No, please, after you. Oh, no, after you. Now, that is bizarre. I tell you what it reminds me of is this fact. We're not suggesting, when we say the things we've said tonight, that every atheist is thus immoral, a killer, a murderer. That's not the point. It's not that a man who's an atheist who pushes God out the door and says, I'm on, that he's going to necessarily be a liar and a cheat and a scoundrel. That's not the point. Many are not. And some who say they believe in God can act in terrible ways, by the way. The point is that though they may be moral people, they have no foundation and basis for that morality without God. Ideas have consequences. One fellow wrote, if the Darwinist are right that morality has a natural source, then morality is not objective or absolute. For if there is no God and humans have evolved from slime, then we have no higher moral status than slime, because there is nothing beyond us to instill with objectivity, morality, or dignity. You know a guy who knew that? This guy. You know what he wrote in Mein Kampf? He said, if nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with the stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior one. Because in such cases, all her efforts throughout hundreds of thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being may be thus rendered futile. But such a preservation goes hand in hand with the inexorable law that it is the strongest and the best who must triumph. And they have the right to endure. He who would live must fight. He who does not wish to fight in this world where permanent struggle is the law of life has not the right to exist. By the way, I have read in more than one place atheists who suggest that Hitler was a Christian. No, that's a lie. Hitler was a Darwinist. That's the truth. And he understood exactly where these principles led. And he worked on that basis. Survival of the fittest. And he decided that some people didn't have the right. They weren't fit to live. Now let me ask you a question. Here's a pro-atheist advertisement you might see. Morality, they say, is doing what's right regardless of what you're told. And religion is doing what you're told regardless of what's right. Isn't that cute? But it leaves a couple of questions unanswered. And one of the biggest is, when you say right, what in the world do you mean without God? Help me understand this. What in the world is right without God? What you like? Or what most of us like? Here's a good question. Say Hitler had won the war. We now live in a society where because of that, because of the propaganda, everyone believed anti-Semitism was good, gassing Jews was a virtue. Would that mean then that it was simply the morality that we must accept? It's what most people believe. It's what most people call good. Is morality simply, at the end of the day, what society thinks about a matter? When we're cut loose from objective truth and we're left with popular vote, what can't be voted yes? How about Peter Singer? He used to teach at Princeton. I don't think he's there anymore now. He's probably an older fellow, sure enough. But he's a Darwinist, and in his book, he created quite a stir many years ago when he wrote about practical ethics. And he said, human babies are not born self-aware or capable of grasping that they exist over time. They're not persons. The life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig or a dog or a chimpanzee. That's you heard that right. What he's arguing for in this particular part of the book is how that we ought to be able to kill children within 28 days of their birth. Not just abortion, 28 days after birth. I don't know why 28 days, for that matter. Why would that be the limit? Now, he writes about that. He says some people are going to feel bad about this. He said we should certainly put very strict conditions on permissible infanticide. But these conditions might owe more to the effects of infanticide on others than the intrinsic wrongness of killing an infant. What is intrinsically wrong? Once we've decided there is no God and each of us is his own God. We could add a lot of examples of this. I'm not going to do it. This is James Rachels. And I want to be fair with Dr. Rachels. He used to be over at UAB when I was a student there, the head of the philosophy department. He wrote a book called Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism. I don't think he's saying this is what he would want, but he's saying that for the Darwinist, if we don't tweak it right, this is where it leads. What would we say about handicapped people, mentally handicapped people, for example? The natural conclusion, according to the doctrine we are considering, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And we perhaps then should go on to conclude that they might be used, as non-human animals are, for laboratory subjects or for food. But what says no to that? I don't like it. Don't tell me it's wrong, because nothing is wrong if if all we've got is just popular vote. It's just a matter of what we all agree on. A couple of other geniuses wrote a book on rape from the Darwinist perspective, and they decided that rape was a natural biological phenomenon that is the product of evolutionary heritage. So like a leopard spots or a giraffe's elongated neck. You're not going to put a giraffe in jail because his neck's too long, are you? What is wrong? What does that even mean without God in the picture? So the conclusion. Human beings do not determine right and wrong. They discover right and wrong or refuse to. But right and wrong are there whether I believe it or not, whether I know it or not. Objective moral truth. In the second place, without a higher authority, there's only human wish, only human desire. If there's no God, then what Hitler did is just a matter of opinion. We all know that some things are wrong. A sense of right and wrong is in our bones, is programmed within us. The higher sense of what should be, even if we don't live up to it ourselves, did not come from ourselves. It was given to us from above. And that's the point of the lesson tonight. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But we know they do exist. Therefore, we know God exists. I appreciate the kind way you've listened and your kind attention. If you have a question about something that I've said, I want you to share it with me, or an objection to something that I've said. I'd be glad talk with you about it further. Please get out your songbooks and turn to the number that's been selected. We read in Psalm 19 earlier that the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. There is natural witness to the existence of God that cannot be denied. But there is also the law of the Lord. That same psalmist taught us that is perfect, and the statutes of the Lord that are right, and the fear of the Lord that is clean. God has not only given us witness of his existence, he has given us a word by which we come to him. If you tonight need to come to God, hear his word. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. Do you believe in Jesus? If so, we hope that you'll come forward tonight and be baptized into Christ. By the way, as I mentioned earlier, tomorrow night, Lord willing, we plan to spend the entire session on the subject of baptism. What does the Bible teach about that subject? We invite you to come then. But tonight, if you know you ought to be baptized into Christ, do that tonight. If you're here as one who is a child of God, if you have been separated from your Lord by your sin, why not return to him? Return in penitence. He'd be glad to receive you. We'd be glad to help you. Let us know how we can help you right now while we stand.